What do mustaches have to do with women in leadership in medicine?
Is there any truth to blood-curdling movies?
We finally found a place in the brain where we find the Christmas spirit.
And Austin Powers bites back.
Oh my goodness. That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on December 25th, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, of course, this is our annual Christmas version. And so we're taking a look at four studies, all in the British Medical Journal. All of them are tongue-in-cheek.
But they all are true studies. So while a little quirky and funny, studies nevertheless. So where do you want to start?
I think I want to start with the one that's near and dear to my heart. I served up as, what do mustaches have to do with women's leadership in medicine? Wow, turns out that there's more men with mustaches in leadership than there are women.
And this was in a study that was trying to draw attention to the sex-related disparities in academic medical leadership. Now, there's a movement underfoot to increase the representation of women in academic medical leadership. And what better way of doing that than by drawing attention to sex disparities? And rather than comparing them to the number of men in academic medical centers, they compared them to men that had mustaches, because these are considered to be rare events. So to do that, they looked at academic medical departments in the United States, clinical departments in medical schools that were funded by the NIH. So 50 different U.S. medical schools. They looked at the number of department leaders that were women versus those that had mustaches. Presumably they were men. And what they found out was that women accounted for only 13% of departmental leaders at the top 50 NIH-funded medical schools, while mustached leaders accounted for 19%. So whether one looks at women versus men or women versus mustached men, there's still a great disparity.
And while this is kind of amusing to look at it in that way, in some ways it's really rather sobering, since it suggests that certainly women aren't going to be growing mustaches, but that this idea that we really need to increase women leadership is important.
It is. And Elizabeth, just example for your institution, the mustache index, and that was the number of women leaders relative to mustache leaders, was 0.17. It was among the lowest of all the institutions. You want to have it one or greater. That is, there are more women than mustache men. Now, you can accomplish that in one of two ways, either recruiting more women or shaving the mustaches off the men at Hopkins. Which would you prefer?
I'm not sure, but it suggests that there's an awful lot of guys around here with mustaches, and just reflecting on those in the faculty I know, that's absolutely true.
All right, so rather than shaving their mustaches, let's recruit more women leaders.
I agree with that one. Let's turn then to a study taking a look at the localization of the Christmas spirit in the brain. Gosh, our imaging is so powerful, we could even find that.
The Christmas spirit is widely described. It's a compilation of things, receiving gifts and delightful smells and feelings of joy and nostalgia. But where exactly is this Christmas spirit located? And that's what this study attempted to do. And they did it by looking at functional MRI, the uptake of oxygen in various parts of the brain while people were thinking about things. Specifically, they took 10 healthy people from Denmark who had Christmas traditions and 10 individuals from Denmark that did not have Christmas traditions. Oftentimes, from outside the country. They showed them different pictures. Some had to do with Christmas, some not with Christmas. And they looked at their brain activity. And what they were able to discover was there were five specific areas of the brain that lit up when people talked about Christmas or they were shown pictures of Christmas.
And I'm just going to go out on a limb here and suggest that I bet a lot of those areas were emotional areas and those where serotonin was the neurotransmitter. Just guessing here.
Well, you're right. Some of those areas had to do with somatic senses. Some had to do with spirituality, interestingly enough. And some had to do with recognition of facial emotion. By the way, the authors, tongue-in-cheek, said that they identified these areas so they could help the bah humbug spirit. And their hypothesis was these are areas of the brain that are underdeveloped or underutilized in people that have the bah humbug spirit. And perhaps they were going to manufacture a Santa's cap that they could put on. And when they developed those bah humbug feelings, they could electrically activate those areas of the brain. All very tongue-in-cheek.
Indeed. But gosh, even last week we talked about that electrical stimulation of the brain using a cap. So this is a technology we've already got in place.
Elizabeth, I'll be the first in line to buy the cap when it's manufactured.
I don't think you need any kind of bah humbug correction, just speaking for myself. Let's turn then to something else that both of us question with regard to the Christmas spirit, and that was, wow, there really is a physiologic basis to blood-curdling movies.
For centuries, people have talked about blood-curdling, and it's been used to describe extreme fear under frightening situations or conditions. And what more notable way to do that, to demonstrate that, than to show very scary movies. And by the way, this is not just in the United States, but they have similar terms in France and Germany, in the Netherlands as well. The hypothesis was that in medieval times, that fear or horror would, quote, run the blood cold, end quote, or, quote, curdle, end quote, congeal the blood. So these authors attempted to decide whether that was actually true or not. So here's what they did. They took 24 healthy volunteers, all under the age of 30, and they randomized them to watch either an educational movie or a scary movie. Now, by the way, these participants had no idea what kind of movies they were going to watch. All they knew was that blood samples were going to be drawn. They'd be watching two movies a week apart at the exact same time of the day. Those that watched the educational movies, bloods were drawn before and afterwards. There was no difference in the coagulation factors. However, those that watched the scary movie, one called Insidious, which was produced in 2010, had an increase in one of their coagulation factors, that is in factor 8, a factor that is associated with increased coagulation. So there may be some truth to this idea that there is blood-curdling movies.
Then did they cross these folks over? So the ones who saw the benign movie then saw the scary movie and had the same blood drawn?
Absolutely. Some of them watched the educational movie first and then the scary movie. Some watched the scary movie first and then the educational movie. Now, by the way, they had to throw out one of the volunteers. This was their third of the 24 subjects because before the movie, he was unable to relax. And to do so, he had to eat a box of chocolates. And then after watching the educational movie, he fainted. So this is an individual who wasn't affected by the scary movie, but by the educational movie.
Or by the blood draw, so-called convulsive syncope, as we're well aware. Finally, then, let's turn to this myth that I'd have to say that I would lend credence to in my personal exposures, but gosh, it turns out that people in the UK don't have worse teeth than Americans.
So I was unaware that there's this longstanding belief in the United States that the British have terrible teeth, in fact, much worse than the oral care received in the United States. And when you think about it, though, that's promulgated in things like The Simpsons or Austin Powers, who has this repugnant smile. So these investigators, one on each side of the pond, one at the University College in London and one at the Harvard School of Public Health, spearheaded this study with their colleagues to do a cross-sectional analysis of U.S. and English teeth by looking at national surveys. In total, they had about 17,000 individuals. They asked them, how many teeth are you missing? And does your oral care impact upon your life? And how satisfied are you with your dental or oral care? And what they noticed was that the mean number of missing teeth was actually significantly higher in the United States than it was in the United Kingdom. 7.3 missing teeth in the United States versus 6.9 in the United Kingdom. Nevertheless, the impact of oral health in England was higher than it was in the United States. So the best we can do is conclude that oral health is no better in the U.S. than in the United Kingdom.
I'm wondering if people are really reflecting on the aesthetic of it. And I guess one question I would ask is, were those missing teeth the ones in the front or in the back in the U.K. versus the United States?
Well, as you're aware, there are differences of opinions about whether molar teeth should be kept in or should be removed. I think more removed in the United States than the United Kingdom. On the flip side, the United Kingdom has national health policies that provide dental care for everybody, where the United States is primary third-party payer. So there's different access as well. And by the way, that certainly affects oral care. So regardless of whether you think that the oral care is better in the U.S. or United Kingdom, this study has to put a smile on your face.
On that note then, we'd like to thank all of our listeners. We consider you among our many blessings in our lives, and we wish you all a very merry and a blessed Christmas. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And very happy holidays. I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.